Before we get started, I want to personally invite you to join me for a live FinTech Leaders recording with Mike Seckler, CEO of JustWorks, one of the largest tech and fintech companies built in New York City. Join us at Barclays Rise in the heart of New York City on Tuesday, April 9 at 4 p.m. You can visit the show notes on Substack to register for free. See you there.
When you think about it, your job as a leader is to make sure that everybody that you're leading understands what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then they have the right tools, environments, colleagues, whatever it is, to be successful with that thing. And if you're focusing on those two things as a leader and you're able to nail them, that's like 90% of the job. And most engineers are reticent to lead people because code is deterministic and people are not, right? The idea of artificial general intelligence, that AI that can think like a human and actually behave like a human and have creative ideas like a human, that's not even something that's like, that's still pure science fiction. That's not even something we even have line of sight to. Like, that's not a real thing, right?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to FinTech Leaders, coming to you from New York City. I'm your host, Miguel Armaza. I'm a co-founder of Gilgamesh Ventures, a venture capital fund that backs early-stage fintech entrepreneurs in the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you enjoyed this conversation, I invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever you get your show so more people can learn about FinTech Leaders. In this episode, I sit down with Nick Petty, CTO of Clear, a publicly traded company with over 20 million members that's built one of the largest identity platforms in the world. If you've ever traveled through an airport in the US, you've definitely seen them. Most recently, Clear expanded into financial services by launching its first reusable KYC solution. In this episode, we discuss the future of digital identity and why reusability is crucial, lessons and secrets to great management, what it takes to run a great technology organization, why AI will not take our jobs anytime soon, and a lot more. Nick, all the way from Chelsea, New York.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Here from Chelsea, live.
Great. So, Nick, I'm looking forward to this conversation. I think all of us, at least in the US, are familiar with Clear, but we're familiar with the brand through the airport.
Absolutely. Yes.
Not through going to the bank, not by interacting in payments, although you guys want to be an important player in our space. But before we go there, let's hear a bit about you, Nick. I mean, I know you spent time at PayPal, Capital One, JP Morgan before Clear. What did you learn in those places?
Yeah, it's fascinating the opportunities and privileges I've had, actually, because I don't think of myself as like a finance or a payments guy, although it's fair to say that's the majority of my career. I think of myself as an engineer, and I like to go solve interesting problems. And it turns out that finance has a lot of interesting problems, right? And there's a bunch of different things that are problematic there. You would think in 2024 that moving money between point A and point B would be like super simple, and yet it's the most complicated it's ever been, right? And if you think about just breaking down a bank for a second or any financial institution, your job is to hold money and then move money. That's kind of the whole thing, right? You think it'd be super simple, but it's not. And my favorite way that I love to illustrate that point is zooming out payments specifically, because the most visceral, the most obvious. I have some money, I give it to Miguel. Miguel takes the money. That's the end of the transaction. You think it would just be that simple. But in reality, it's not. And here's why, right? Because there's a fundamental trade-off between the security, safety, and privacy of the transaction and then the actual user experience, right? And the reason that you think about Clear and the airport and sort of why we think about stepping into space is that trade-off is something that we, especially in American society, but certainly globally as well, make all the time, sometimes sort of unintentionally, right? We assume that because something is of high risk or require some sort of high level of regulatory compliance or protection of some kind, that just automatically means, well, it's going to be a less than ideal experience, but I just have to get through that, right? The one that everybody's familiar with is the airport checkpoint, right? Like, you know, it's not going to be very pleasant. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be lots of people. The good folks at TSA are doing their best to get people through, but travel is hard and getting harder all the time, right? And it's generally not a great experience, right? And so that's kind of where Clear came in and leveraged technology to have the and, right? That's what I like to say about all the time is you don't have to make a trade-off. You can have both, or you can have the safety and security and a good experience. So I'm bringing that back to finance and payments for a second as an example, right? Imagine two payments companies, one on either end of the spectrum. On the one hand, you got a payments company that is like this amazing UX, instant payments, no limits, just put in somebody's name, tell them how much you want to send them, and boom, the payment arrives. Sounds awesome. You and I would use it for the first 24 hours it was alive until it collapsed under the weight of its own fraud and money laundering and all the other things that will come along with that, right? But it'd be an amazing experience for the consumer for the first 24 hours. Other side of the spectrum, you've got a payments company that has draconian checkpoints. Every transaction requires three humans to evaluate it over the course of multiple weeks and an in-person visit to prove who you are. There would be zero fraud on that platform, but nobody would use it because it would be a terrible experience, right? And so like, the key to moving money in any financial institution is finding a sweet spot between those two ends of that spectrum, right? How do you sort of have the right level of safety, security, privacy, compliance, but also create an easy, frictionless, nice experience? I think a really interesting example of this is Zelle, right? So Zelle is a really great service, and it's won by a consortium of banks, right? But at least when they first launched, it was a little bit too far on the side of the user experience versus the fraud, right? And they kind of had to bring it back in line, or each of the banks is kind of working to bring it back in line. And on the flip side, I think you've had lots of examples of payment services that try to be really safe and secure, but really nobody uses because it's so hard to use. I mean, that's a big piece of the learning I've taken away from all those experiences, where you know, there's payments, money movement of any kind, brokerage, anything like that. It's always that trade-off between those two things. And I think that what's exciting about Clear, and the reason I ultimately came to work here, is that I think that through technology, you can actually alleviate that problem and create a really interesting opportunity for everybody playing in the finance space.
Nick, to talk a little bit about your past companies, one that pretty much started as a fintech is Capital One. Now, obviously, one of the largest banks in the country and about to get larger if the acquisition goes through.
What an interesting acquisition that is, too.
Yeah. So many. We should have a podcast just about that acquisition.
Surely.
But what is special about Capital One? Why have they been able to get to where they are today?
That is a fascinating question, and one I love to talk about because I love Capital One. That was a great company to work for, and I think a really interesting technology-forward financial institution. The thing that a lot of people don't think about when they think about Capital One that I think is really important to answer that question is going all the way back to pre-internet days. Right. So Capital One started as a credit card company. But the thing that people don't think about a lot with Capital One that's really the secret sauce is data. So they've been doing A/B experiments before A/B experiments were cool. Right. They used to, back when it was mailing, when it was mailers, right? Like, apply for this credit card. Here's a form you can fill out. Right. They're sending them to your house. Any one of those mailers had 100 experiments going at one time, like the font size, the position of the logo, like the envelope they use, everything. They were constantly dialing it. And that's really what kind of infused their success in the credit card business, was that ability to sort of like find the right marketing and sort of like the right customer proof points at the right product offerings and so on and so forth. And then they kind of took that forward into everything else they did. And so everything about that bank and everything about what they do is so data driven. I mean, everybody says they're data driven. Everybody has lots of data, and that's fair and true. But I have rarely in my experience seen a company of any kind, much less a bank, really walk that walk the way Cap One does, right? And so then when it came to advancing into other parts of the financial industry, I think that just became so infused into the culture of the company that everything they did was about that. When I was there, we were in the throes of that very first step towards public cloud. And that was even again a data-driven decision, right? When you think about the security, the efficiency of developing new products, new technologies, the robustness and reliability. At that time, anyway, I think if you mark it today, 2024, there's maybe a different sentiment about cloud versus on-prem and how people are thinking about the cost there. But at least a decade ago, let's call it, that was really a hard push for Capital One. And they were really pioneers in that space. First major bank to be in the public cloud and effectively so. And so even that was, I think, a very data-driven tech-forward decision on their part that I think has changed the face of that company in a really positive way.
Now, I'm sure you carry those lessons with you and you've carried them onwards after your time at Cap One. Before Clear, you had a pretty interesting role at JP Morgan, which was head of payments for the consumer side of JPM, which is massive, of course. But I'm curious, I mean, that is an amazing job. Why would you leave it? Was there something in that role that kind of led you to experience the pain points that you're trying to solve now? Is that connection exist?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably fair to say at some point, but I would probably characterize it differently just because I love my time at JPMorgan Chase as well. And I think that if the opportunity at Clear hadn't come along, I'd frankly still be there doing a bang-up job with that amazing team. Shout out to my team over at Chase. I think that, but what I definitely did experience the underlying challenges of identity in the broader ecosystem. So zooming out from just payments for a second, that payments is where I was focused for the consumer bank. And so just to reorient people briefly, right, for JPMorgan Chase, there's the consumer bank, which is what people mostly know as Chase. There's the commercial bank, investment bank, and the private asset wealth banks. I mean, and those are each massive, massive companies, right? So in many ways, you might as well be on different planets in the same solar system when you're in each of those companies. I was focused on the consumer bank. And payments there was, I think at the time, we were processing over $5 trillion in payments a year, which is a massive, massive number. And so really got to experience what those pain points look at massive scale. And I'm guessing most of your audience knows a lot of those pain points. And there's everything from, again, security, regulatory compliance, the whole gamut of things. But the thing that I always kind of came back to underlying was identity. And I think that expands beyond just the financial sector into anybody who's a denizen of the internet. And I'm a Gen Xer who kind of grew up in my teens and beyond living on the internet. Having lived and worked on the internet for decades now, so many of the problems we have in general are because of identity in some way, shape, or form. And by the way, I don't make light of that problem. Like, oh, clearly everybody should just have an identity on the internet. I kind of think that's true, actually, but I wouldn't be so cavalier as to say that we need to change the entire nature of the internet to be different. I think it's similar to any other important and challenging aspects of society that we have. And again, these things are foundational. So think about things like driving a car, transportation, right? I mean, these are areas where you're required to provide identity, get a license of some kind. You don't need a driver's license to get around on the road. You can ride a bus, you can ride the subway, you can walk, lots of things. But if you want to get the fast path, if you want to have the sort of the privilege of that specific thing, there needs to be some identity, right? And my personal opinion is I think the internet, it's time for that to be the case as well, where, yeah, there's plenty of things on the internet that you should absolutely be anonymous for, and that's one of the benefits of the internet. There's plenty of things where you should not be anonymous, and we don't really have a sound foundational identity layer across the digital society, if you will, to provide that. And that then begets all kinds of really interesting problems, not the least of which is the one we're talking about today. And so when I started talking to Clear, it kind of did connect some dots for me that like, oh, wow, like the airport business is fantastic and it's a great brand. It's a great product. And one of the really great aspects of working at Clear is hearing all the really great stories from our customers about how the product saved them or helped them in some way, shape, or form, made a difference for their experience in travel. I love that so much because I love talking to our customers that way. But if you kind of zoom out abstractly from what we've built in the airport so far and think about that for a second, it is a relatively universal platform. All it really is doing is taking an identity using some technology, in this case, biometrics, but in the future, maybe something else. And you're authenticating that you are who you say you are and then authorizing you for some context. Now, in the airport, that authorization is very simple. You're allowed to go through the security checkpoint. But in other contexts, that could be other things. It could be buying alcohol. It could be renting a car. It could be going to an event of some kind, right? There's all kinds of things. It could be your vaccination status. It could be all kinds of things could be tied to your identity and authenticating you and then authorizing that thing becomes a really useful and important aspect of almost every aspect of life. And so when I thought about Clear and I thought about the opportunity, and I started to kind of pull that thread and unpack a little bit, I realized, oh geez, actually this could almost apply to anything. Right. Almost anything could benefit from that. And that was kind of the light bulb moment of like, oh, wow, like identity is so fundamental to society and so many different ways that we are using it is so antiquated and frankly, we got painful that, wow, there's a real opportunity to make a big impact in, I don't think it's too grandiose to say civilization. And that was really what ultimately attracted me to take the role and to join Clear.
So you obviously have all the history of Clear and what Clear has built. But there's also a new angle for Clear, which is the Sora ID acquisition. How does that fit in? And maybe tell us your vision of how the product is going to look for your customers, a XYZ bank.
Yeah, how it currently looks, actually. I'm really, really thrilled and excited that we've done a really aggressive and solid job of integrating Sora post acquisition into now a really compelling product. And I think that what we had when we looked to go beyond the airport into other verticals that might benefit from what we have, much of what we had already built in the airport as a platform kind of already persists. It's the same level of security, the same underlying technology we use for biometrics, same level of sort of compliance, right? It's what we like to tell our customers is the same level of security and compliance we give the DHS is what we give to you as well, right? Sort of same underlying technology. And that technology just kind of, as it stands, can be leveraged in a bunch of different places for a bunch of really different important aspects of our daily lives. And so we're really proud of that. When we enter into the financial space, which has obvious synergies for us, and started to think about things like KYC, for example, that then, as many of your audience, I'm sure, knows, has sort of another level or upper echelon of what sort of expectations there. Not only that, but it's actually quite complex in terms of how you might interpret compliance with the various KYC requirements. And each bank does it slightly differently with slightly different requirements or how they think about it, right? And so what Sora really brought to the table that I think rounded out our product in the space was that much broader set of configurable capabilities that sort of bring those additional checks and additional sort of balances that we need to do to really have a full-featured KYC product. And so now I'm actually really proud to say that we have that today, and we're talking to a lot of different financial institutions about leveraging that product in a variety of different use cases. But it really was about being able to address the configurability, the extensibility, and sort of the broad landscape of KYC within the financial space, and sort of bringing a very customizable but very effective and very powerful platform to that problem set.
So Nick, this is KYC, KYB, anti-fraud solutions. That's a topic that I see it come up super often. Number one, new companies try to solve this, and we actually at Gilgamesh Ventures have invested in a good number tackling different parts of the problem, right? Also on the podcast, I've been fortunate to interview a few identity and anti-fraud leaders. And, you know, part of the conversation is always centered around how is the future of identity going to look like, right? Everyone's afraid of, you know, new tools. Yeah, they're exciting and they're new productivity tools. But at the same time, people are afraid that it's only going to make it harder to catch fraud. We're going to be even more bombarded by all sorts of attacks. Tell us about your vision of how do you think the future of identity in financial services is going to look like?
So that's a great question, Miguel. And I think my immediate answer, I have a bunch of ways I can answer that question, because like we could probably spend the rest of the podcast just talking about that. But my immediate thought is reusable identity. I think that is, I think, a different sort of bend on how we think about identity. That's maybe different from some of the offerings that are out there today and how I think identity has been thought about broadly up until now. So let me explain what I mean by a reusable identity. So once you've gone through the process of essentially proving who you are, who you say you are. And then there's a variety of different ways that we do that to varying degrees of sort of data assurance, depending on your requirements. So for example, going through the airport has our highest level of data assurance, obviously. If you're just going to a Taylor Swift concert at Madison Square Garden, we need much less from you and everything in between. But regardless of sort of where that ends up being proofing you, the point is that you've gone through some steps to provide that proof, right? You've given us a government issued document. We've perhaps pulled some background data about you. We've certainly taken a selfie and done some sort of biometric check. There's all kinds of things we've done to sort of establish our identity. Once you've done that one time, there's not really a need to do that again. And so I think that's where CLEAR's offering really comes into the picture. And you think about anybody who's had that experience at the airport, it's the same idea, right? So you enroll with CLEAR the first time through. It takes a couple minutes. You do it at the pod. It's really super fast, but you do a couple things. We grab all that information about you. We persist that in a very secure way. And then the next time you come through the lane, it's much simpler. Iris or fingerprint, boom, you're done and through, right? We want to bring that same experience to all the other facets of identity, not least which is finance. So think about, I think it's probably fair to say that most Americans have a relationship with more than one bank, and that it, or more than one financial institution, I should say. And in doing so, those consumers have probably done some version of KYC a bunch of different times, right? And it's usually going to be the same stuff with some additional, to my point earlier about sort of the broad landscape of KYC, some additional details depending on individual financial institutions. But the consumer doesn't need to do that. And I think that most financial institutions would say that like the conversion rate of that experience and how you both bring new customers on board in a frictionless way, but also make sure it's secure and compliant and a good experience for the customer, that's very challenging. And so where reusable identity comes to play now is that you've already established that identity and done all those checks in a secure way that can then be preferred to a new use case, a new node in the network, if you will, then that becomes much easier and safer. So in other words, that experience could look like, I'm coming to new financial institution XYZ. I'm already a CLEAR member who's proof of identity at some level. And this new financial institution is asking me to KYC or sign up in some way, shape, or form. Oh, I see an option to use CLEAR. That's great. I click on the CLEAR button. It pops up a little modal. It's embedded in the experience. It goes, let me just grab a quick selfie. Check. Oh, yep, that's Nick. Okay, here's all the information about Nick that you need to know. Account is open. Now, for the consumer, that's a way better experience, but also it's secure, safe, private. They've consented to it. They're aware of what data is being shared. It's all within their control and hands. But for the financial institution, they've made this experience almost frictionless, right? It's so near to like instant that it's painfully awesome, right? Like just how, why can't we just do this for everything? And in fact, with the mobile experience and with the advent and growing popularity of passkeys, we can actually even skip some of that entirely and make it even easier. Because if you're on a device that's known and registered to your identity, using the passkey, we can also securely do that without even, we can skip the selfie step, right? So there's even we can make that even more frictionless. And so bringing that to, I think, the future use of really anything. And by the way, I hope it's clear to the audience, like, this is not a problem that's necessarily exclusive to financial institutions. So I think that's an area where we can make a lot of impact and where it's like most foundational. But that same equation I just described can be applied in a bunch of different use cases. We think about healthcare. We think about digital marketplaces. We think about anywhere where identity matters. And where, think about trust and safety and places where you might rent a car or maybe doing ride sharing, or maybe you're renting somebody's house, or there's lots of different ways that you could be doing those things where you would really like to know that the person on the other end of that equation has an identity that's been vetted and is of some level of assurance. Again, going back to my own revelations, if you sort of zoom out and think about the broader picture of like how you just conduct yourself in the physical and digital world every day, there's a dozen opportunities to prove your identity and authorize yourself for something almost every day you do it. Every time you reach for your wallet for something, it's there.
And in a world where we see cyber attacks hitting companies more often than they should, honestly, and where CLEAR has some very sensitive data about your customers, your users, how do you guys think about that ugly side of the business, right? The constant, I guess, cyber attacks.
Well, I would say is that's an area where we can help maybe most of all, right? Because if you unpack those cyber attacks these days, the vast, vast majority of cyber attacks are really social engineering or credential loss of some kind, right? Somebody stole a password somewhere or got something. Somebody reused a password or was irresponsible with their credentials. Somebody else, some bad actor got their hands on it and they were able to slip into the system and then from there do a bunch of damage. There's a massive, massive ongoing cyber attack happening in the healthcare space right now that I think is right, that a lot of people are seeing real time. They have not yet announced what the root cause of that is. They're still fighting fires, I imagine. Miguel, I'm going to mark my words here on this podcast. I guarantee you when they finally come around to talking about what had happened and how they got through it, I guarantee you it's going to start with somebody got social engineered or somebody had their password stolen or somebody forgot to reset their password or something like that happened that ultimately was the root cause of everything. Again, it comes back to identity. I mean, there are so many different places where you have to call into a call center to reset a password or where you have to go through some painfully simple KBA process that anybody could guess or maybe steal some information to get through, right? In all of these cases, you're basically leaving the front door or the back door in that case open for bad actors because of identity, right? So if you could just put an identity check that's secure and safe and easy in front of that, you eliminate a lot of those challenges, right? And you make it much harder for the bad guys.
Nick, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about your organization. So what makes an effective CTO, but I guess more importantly, an effective technology unit?
Oh man, that's a great question. Again, I could fill the rest of the podcast on that one, but I'll try to keep it concise. I think it's a couple of things, and it will maybe not surprise your audience to learn that most of them are not technical. And I think the longer I've done this job, and by the way, I start off by saying I'm an engineer's engineer. I often joke with my team that it's only been the last few years of my career that I've even like emotionally accepted the idea that I'm not a developer anymore. Like I haven't been a developer for a paycheck in like a decade or more, but in my heart, I still kind of am. And so I think a lot about those technical problem sets. And for a while in my career, like probably many, if there's any engineers or technical people that are listening to this podcast, they might resonate with the idea like at some point you had to sort of decide to be a hardcore IC or to lead people, right? And most engineers are reticent to lead people because code is deterministic and people are not, right? For me, I was lucky, I think, to sort of hit upon the notion fairly early in my career that Although, yes, like figuring out people is hard and undeterministic and is not the same as dealing with computers. The reality is if you want to have impact, you want to do things that are meaningful, make products that are useful in society, you need to work with other people. There's no such thing as the lone wolf. There just isn't. And so once that clicked in my head in terms of what mattered for me in terms of impact, that's when I started focusing my personal attention on, okay, how do I get good at leading people? How do I get good at answering that question? Like, what is it that's required, right? And a couple of things that immediately popped to mind. The first and foremost, that is a little bit on the technical side, but I think it applies everywhere, is curiosity. Growth mindset, wanting to know why things work the way they work or how things work, or teach me about that. That's honestly been a major driver in my career, in that every single time I've had an opportunity to jump into a new space. So, you know, when I joined Cap One, I didn't know anything about brokerage. I became a Series 99 licensed operator, like in the process of doing so, because I wanted to learn about brokerage, right? After that, I joined Uber and stood up Uber Grocery for the first time. I didn't know anything about the grocery business. I learned a ton, right? And so on and so forth. So I'm always seeking new opportunities and learn new things and apply the same sort of engineering principles to them. So I think a growth mindset and curiosity is really, really important for technologists in general, but certainly for leaders as well. The most common pain point that people in my position, I think, often address is, how do you both do your job and stay technical at the same time? At some point, you get far enough away from the code and the technology that you don't really necessarily have that credibility anymore, right? And this is my primary answer to that. You don't have to let yourself languish into sort of irrelevance, right? You can absolutely continue to seek new information, new skill sets, learn about new things. You don't have to be deep, deep experts in them because you're no longer hands-on keyboard per se, but you can certainly learn a lot. So that's like number one, two, and three in my answer is that one. Beyond that, however, I think it's really kind of a very basic set of principles, and this was told to me by a mentor in my time, and I will pass it now on to your audience. I think is a really key gem that I think about all the time, is my North Star, if you will. This came about some years back when I was having a walking, talking, where do you want to be in 10 years sort of career conversation with my boss at the time. I was head of engineering, he was CTO. Where do you want to be? And I was like, I want your job, man. I want to be CTO one day. He's like, great, cool. Like, what do you think a CTO does? I'm like, well, you know, a CTO does this and this and this and this. He's like, yeah, nope, that is all wrong. I was like, wait, what do you mean? Like, I've been around the block. I know what a CTO does. He's like, no, listen, if I'm doing my job correctly, I do two things. I set the vision and strategy for what needs to happen, and I make sure they have the right people to do it. Full stop. Now, two things, as soon as I process that, two things immediately occur to me. The first one is, oh, that's like a North Star. Like, the reality is, much like site reliability, we talk about site reliability in terms of nines, right? Right now it's like 3 nines, 4 nines of reliability. The reason we say that is because we know that 100% is sort of unachievable. Like, you're always going to get as close to it as possible, ideally, but you never get all the way there, right? So I'm never going to have a perfect equation if I only ever set the vision and then hire the people and then I just do nothing, right? Like, it's always going to be stuff in between. But every time I find that stuff in between, I just go, wait a minute. I should have either explained to somebody or delegated to somebody. I've done something wrong here, right? Let me think about that. So it's like that constant North Star. The other thing I realized was that's not really germane necessarily just at CTOs. That can be really at all people leader levels of all disciplines, right? Is that when you think about it, your job as a leader is to make sure that everybody that you're leading understands what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then they have the right tools, environments, colleagues, whatever it is to be successful at that thing. And if you're focusing on those two things as a leader, and you're able to nail them, that's like 90% of the job.
How do you make sure that you have the right people? Out of the two, that sounds like the hardest thing to get done.
Yep. And that is definitely the art behind the science. So I don't know if I could give you let me tell you, Miguel, here's the formula for how you get the right people. I would like to think that I've been fairly successful at that, but I can't say that I've done, but here are the two things I do that always makes that true. I do think that it starts with realizing that is the most important and hardest thing you can do, right? It starts with, oh, if I'm spending all my time doing and not spending most of my time on making sure that I have the right people. And then when I do have the right people, make sure that I'm giving them feedback and growth opportunities and make sure that I'm caring and feeding for them so they are successful and growing as well. And then the inverse of that, when they're not being successful and you're sort of giving them that hard feedback and sort of managing that situation, right? The only real solid answer I have for you in terms of how to do that is focus on it. Be intentional with it. Understand that that is most of your job. Most of your job as a leader at any level and in any discipline is on making sure that the people that work for you are the right people and that they're successful.
And it sounds like you don't think that someone could be a successful CTO at a large company without being an engineer or technical leader themselves.
No, I would not say that, actually. I think I do think that as a CTO, you have to have a certain level of credibility, right, in order to attract that talent. And so there does need to be some technical shots. But I'll tell you, I as an engineer have worked for leaders who were, did not come from an engineering background, but were good enough people leaders and had enough credibility in terms of what they understood and how they operated, that in many cases, those were some of the best manager-employee relations I've ever had. I do think it comes down to, back to what I was saying earlier about that growth mindset, right? If you didn't come from a technology background, but you have a growth and curiosity mindset, and so you're constantly asking, why, how does this work? Let me look at this. Then you can effectively manage that with the right people. Now, having said all that, Miguel, obviously having a strong engineering background and a strong technical experience makes a big difference as well. But I would not exclusively say that has to be the case.
Over the years, I've collaborated, I've worked with some very good engineers. And one thing that is true is they want to be challenged. They want to be working on what they consider interesting, right? And I know some CTOs can achieve that by also, you have your core that you're working on, but on the side, you're always running some experiments, right? So like, and then can you recall, like, is this something you do, or can you recall maybe some interesting instances where that has yielded interesting results?
Yeah, a couple of cases, and you're absolutely right. Like, I would say you do have to find an interesting balance between the care and feeding of the tinkering of engineers. I'm the same way, by the way, right? With also having business impact, right? And doing things for purpose. My experience is, to your point, most engineers like to tinker and fiddle and learn and grow. That's actually great. I am not interested in technology for technology's sake. And I tend to seek out other engineers who feel the same way. I'm interested in technology as applied to solve problems. I don't have to be money-making problems per se, but I do want to see about solving problems. I think that's what engineers do. And so from that experience, things generally have to be oriented towards let's solve problems. But to your point, sometimes you don't know how you might solve a problem if you don't play around a little bit, experiment, see what's there, right? Let's figure out some things. And not to put too fine a point on it, but with the mainstream excitement around AI that's happened in the last year and a half, that is prime territory for a lot of experimentation, right? And a lot of really interesting opportunities. And there's a couple of things I can't say too much about right now, Miguel, but I will say that we are experimenting with some AI technology outside of the obvious around facial verification, the things that are sort of our bread and butter, LLMs and more generative AI. And what's really exciting, and I'm sure every technologist of every era has said this at some point, what a time to be alive. The future is now. Incredible. But I really do kind of think in the last couple of years, we've been living in the future to a certain extent. I mean, we think about ChatGPT and Vision Pro and all these things that have been coming out. It's like, holy crap, this is amazing technology. But more importantly, and I think this is the key point, it's amazingly accessible technology, right? Like, the thing that I think is really fascinating about ChatGPT, and I don't mean to take your question and immediately turn towards LLMs, but that's immediately where my brain goes. The thing that's fascinating about LLMs and ChatGPT and things like that is that it starts to democratize and sort of lower the barrier to entry to a lot of things. Earlier, I had said to you that there's no such thing as the one I see that has this massive impact. It requires a team no matter what, right? But I'll go back on my words a little bit and say with the rise of AI and with the rise of AI agents in particular, and I'll talk about that in a second because that's the real answer to your question, that I'm excited to see in the not too distant future the first one-person unicorn. Right. The first one person company that hitches unicorn status, because it was one person with an idea and a set of AI agents that did all the work for her, whatever that ends up being. An AI agent, I think, is the place where I'm excited and where we have a bunch of experimentation happening internally right now. So not to get too technical, but for your audience, in case they're not familiar, right? The idea of an agent is this notion that multiple LLMs can be orchestrated to work together. And what's interesting about that idea is that early research shows that even just two LLMs are working together. And when I say working together, I mean, they literally chat with each other. Right. Literally, it's what you and I would do with an LLM, but it's two LLMs together, right? When two LLMs work together, the output of that in terms of the quality of it and the accuracy of it is multiplicative, not additive. Meaning, so it's not two LLMs, it's four LLMs for the price of two, right? And so what you start to get is these really interesting scenarios where, with the right sort of orchestration framework around it, you could have multiple LLMs actually solving a problem completely autonomously for you, right? And we've worked on some demos internally where it's literally here's a user story for a feature or a product. Go build it for me. And it's literally just like a user story you put in Jira or something like that. Here's a user story. And then you give it to the LLM. And then that LLM orchestrates across a bunch of different LLMs, writes the code, debugs it, compiles it, pushes it out there, and boom, you have a product. I've literally done this myself with a bare bones iOS app. And by the way, I know nothing about iOS apps. right, from a coding perspective. But with an agent and a little bit of product knowledge, I was able to make something within a couple minutes that is very functional, right? So this notion of, somebody else said this to me, so I won't take credit for it, but I love the way that they said this. The idea of agents means that the one-point story goes away, meaning there's those simple, tedious tasks that are required to improve a feature or fix a bug or whatever it is that would happen. That's the thing of the past. Now just give it to the agent, let them solve it. You can focus on the bigger picture problems. That level of experimentation, what I love about that is it, and it might be different from what your question is, but like what I love about that is it's about the tool, right? It's about the tool you're using to solve the problem. We get so focused on the problem set sometimes we forget to worry about the tools. And my view is, as a craftsperson, you care as much about the tools as the thing you're using on the tools, right? And if you worry about both equally, then you get really, really good outcomes. We have some really amazing tools in front of us now. And so I think spending time on that, experimenting with it, will yield outcomes that we haven't even conceived of yet.
Yeah, one of my past guests was Luis Silva, who's the founder CEO of CloudWalk. And they are even experimenting with AI managers within the company. So I don't know, think of a department, like maybe a department that is doing some task that is sort of mechanical. And all of a sudden they report to a chatbot or something like that. But
that sounds a little dystopian, but
yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't want to report to an AI per se. I would certainly love to know that an AI was taking some of the tedium off of the plate of my manager, right? And so some of those, to your point, those, and I think that's the thing, right? It's like, and I always kind of laugh, Miguel, when people say like, oh, is AI coming for our jobs? Are we going to, like, do we even need humans anymore for things? And I would say like, listen, the idea of artificial general intelligence, that AI that can think like a human and actually behave like a human and have creative ideas like a human, that's not even something that's like, that's still pure science fiction. That's not even something we even have line of sight to. Like, that's not a real thing, right? At the end of the day, on some level, these are glorified spell checkers, right? It's a tool that you use, right?
It's the most amazing productivity tool you've seen.
Totally. A super amazing tool, but ultimately still a tool, right? And so, like any good tool, what it's meant to do is take the manual labor and tedium of things off your plate and let you focus on what things humans are good for, which is creativity, ideation, collaboration, right? You know, what I would say to any software developer, and I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you know, am I even gonna have a job anymore once AI gets sophisticated enough? I say, listen, if you think that typing code was the value of this job, then you misunderstood the job. This is now going to take the, you don't have to type code anymore. That's great. But like at some point in the future, we're all going to have like cables from our brains to the computer anyway. And so that whole team goes away, right? So yeah, what is it you bring to the table as a human? Well, let me tell you, it's something that AI is not even close to yet. And that's the creativity aspect of it.
Humanity.
Humanity, man. More important than ever.
Nick, before I let you go, are there any books, maybe one or two books that have inspired you in the past that you often recommend?
Yes. So funny that you asked that, because in years past, I've been fairly remiss in my reading of books. I've done a lot of online reading, a lot of blogs, podcasts, things like that, but not necessarily of books. So last year, I actually kind of made an intentional resolution. I'm going to try to hit one book a month. So I actually had a whole bunch of books last year. I hit 11 out of 12 last year. So I was pretty proud of that. Two books that came away is like one that I was really excited about. I'll give you one fiction and one nonfiction. On the nonfiction side, there's a book called How Hard Things Get Done. It's written by an organization that has compiled this database globally over history of all the quote-unquote big, massive projects. Now, think of it, nuclear reactors, building an airport or a bridge, like these really big projects, right? And they studied them and looked at like where they went wrong and where they went right and why. And it's a really interesting look at how hard things get done, right? Really fascinating looks at things like, I don't know, how Heathrow Airport got built. By the way, disastrous, right? One of the most successful projects in history, Empire State Building. You know, and they talk about why, but you know, just to cut to the chase, like one of the ways they built the Empire State Building was every floor was exactly the same, right? So they kind of cookie cut the floors all the way up, and that made it actually easily to repeat. So the scalability of those things, right? Really interesting book, lots of really interesting anecdotes in there. Probably won't learn a ton about why hard things don't work, but like it's very satisfying, cathartic to see it played out in history. On the fiction side, I read a really great book last year called The Mountain in the Sea. And it's a near future, slightly dystopian look at sort of a post-AI world. And I'll try to tease this without giving anything away to the plot. Basically, it looks at like the idea that octopi might be getting sentience and starting to form civilizations, and like, ooh, that's concerning. We should go take a look at that as humans, right? And then events unfold. what I loved about it was, first of all, it's just really good story, really good writing, which always attracts me. But it was a really interesting look at what it means to be conscious, right? So a pontification about the idea that, like, we as humans can't even really fully define for ourselves what it means to be conscious, much less an AI or an octopus, right? So, like, what is conscious? Like, what is that? Like, and just to tie it all back together, Miguel, like, nice bow for the podcast. Like, what is identity? What is that really? You know, it's something that's sort of core and we understand and we know it and we see it, but to define it out loud is sometimes really, really challenging. And that's one of the sort of underlying big challenges of humans in society.
This octopus from the mouth and the sea reminds me a little bit of, I think his name was Paul the Octopus, which is an octopus that predicted the scores of World Cup games.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But we're not there yet. They're not taking over just yet.
Fair enough.
Nick, thanks for doing this. Very good stuff. I look forward to meeting you in person when I stop by your Chelsea offices. And I'm sure the interest for what Clear is doing in fintech, I'm sure is already high. And it's going to keep growing because this is a massive problem that is not hard to grasp, but it's super hard to fix. And I'm going to be watching very closely.
Miguel, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate the conversation. It was very enjoyable.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this great episode with Nick Petty, CTO of Clear. If you want more interviews, make sure to subscribe, follow, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. It helps and means a lot. And if you have any suggestions or thoughts about the show, just drop me a line on Twitter or LinkedIn. Signing off, till next week, I'm your host, Miguel Armaza.